Hello and welcome to the Vassals of Kingsgrave. We are back this time around to do our usual end-of-the-year video game roundtable, except this one will be a bit different than those that came before. Instead of talking about our favorite games from the year of 2019, we'll be talking about the games that defined this entire decade for each of us, since 2020 is just around the corner. My name is Zach, also known as Alias on the podcast of Ice and Fire Forums, and joining me we have...
Hi, this is Bing. I'm Shushan on the forums.
Hi, this is Katie Lady Griffin on the forums.
And this is Matt Blue Armor on the forums.
Awesome. Thank you all very much for joining me for this. So before we get into our best games of the decade roundtable, I just wanted to quickly go around and see what people have been playing lately at the moment. Is there anything you guys want to shout out?
I'm playing Dragon Age Origins for this.
Excellent. I love it.
Yeah,
doesn't quite make the decade cut.
No, it's short 1 year. Other than that, like, I've almost finished my last Red Dead 2 playthrough that I'm going to... I think it's the last time I'm going to play it for quite a bit, but yeah, I also finished. It's a wonderful game. I haven't had enough of it. I've just, like, played it way too much in the past few months.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Yeah, I know. Like, looking back on it, I realized I've only played, like, two games that have actually come out this year.
Yeah.
And that's Sekiro and Borderlands 3.
Yeah.
And my Borderlands 3 playthrough got interrupted by the release of Civ on console, which I, you know, rebought and been doing that. And now I'm just in the mood to, like, replay stuff like Sekiro and Hollow Knight and...
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons I didn't want to do like a best of 2019. We partially because we talked about a lot of the games in our last cast, but also because I just don't think there's that many good games this year. Like, there weren't that many that I thought were great.
Yeah, no, the only thing that would compete with Sekiro as my favorite game of the year would be Fire Emblem Three Houses that I haven't played. Yeah, I haven't played because I don't own a Switch. So
those are my top two.
I just started playing a game called Phoenix Point.
Yeah.
Made by the same people who made XCOM. I think the original XCOM, right?
Oh, nice.
So.
What do you think of it?
So far it's good. It's actually more like the other, turn-based strategy, Battletech a bit more than, XCOM. It's more fiddly.
Yeah, I've heard that. I've heard it's kind of janky. Is it early access or is it just kind of a Kickstarter game?
It's a Kickstarter game. It's out now, I think.
Okay.
But yeah, I think there's still a lot of rough parts to it. They also made a statement saying that they forgot to, they had some mix up with Steam, so it's not on Steam.
Right. The whole Epic Game Store menace.
Yeah.
And all that stuff.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's been a
thing. Not great, Bob.
Nope. Yeah. So that and, I guess Magic the Gathering Arena just technically officially released this like 2 months ago, but whatever.
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, I played the new Star Wars game recently, the EA Respawn game, Jedi Fallen Order, and it was pretty good. We haven't had a good Star Wars game in a long time. I think since like, I mean, you could say The Force Unleashed was a good game. I think that's debatable. But like, since like KOTOR, Jedi Academy, we really haven't had a really solid Star Wars game ever since basically Disney and EA had the license. There really hasn't been anything special, but this game was fun. Like, the characters in it were really well done, especially the secondary characters that are on the ship with you. The combat's fun. It does try to basically do what Sekiro's doing. Not quite at the same level, but it's still really fun to do this kind of deflect-based combat with a lightsaber, of course. And yeah, it was a good experience. I really enjoyed it, so I'm glad that hopefully things are going in the right direction for Star Wars games.
Is that a BioWare release?
No, it's Respawn, who made Titanfall and Apex Legends, which is their other game this year.
Yeah.
Not BioWare. I don't even know what BioWare is doing. I guess Dragon Age.
Teasing us on Twitter.
Right, weren't we supposed to get something?
Yeah, the most they did was kind of like ask very vague questions that like infuriate me, but like there was one developer who was like, "What would you do if you had a dog in the next game?" And I'm like, "Fuck you, just tell me when it's coming out."
Yeah, like in the first game I had a dog, I don't know. Can't park him in the camp and not do anything.
Yeah. I don't know.
I did some like heavy research into Jedi and Death Stranding as well to see if I wanted to buy those games, and I...
Has anyone played Death Stranding?
Alright, so I haven't played Death Stranding. I have watched three different playthroughs of Death Stranding at this point, and I kind of like it, to be honest. I kind of like Death Stranding.
Yeah, no, I like...
Not having played it, to be fair.
Yeah, no, I like the idea of it. And yeah, and so, you know, a lot of this is reading reviews, and then also Girlfriend Reviews obviously does a great job at kind of breaking down these games.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, so my conclusion with Death Stranding is that kind of, you know, the later on, the second half of the game looks, you know, a lot of fun and really good. But similar to my feelings on Red Dead, I just think that the opening sections of the game and the shitty mechanics I don't think I could get past them in order to make it to like the better part of the game.
Yeah, it's weird, right? The gameplay of Death Stranding looks horrible. And to be fair, again, yeah. I have not played it, but there is something I think that does happen that is cool about this like traversal of the huge map and doing these deliveries. And most importantly, the ways that your game interacts with other players' games, where you can build things for other players, they can build things for you. And it's kind of this sort of like asymmetric, indirect multiplayer that I think is so cool. Like that's kind of like what Journey does. Well, in that you actually interact with someone, but you can't actually communicate. But like that kind of multiplayer that's not quite multiplayer, I love that kind of stuff. And I think Death Stranding is doing some cool stuff with that. And I think there's something you kind of fall into the, from what I can tell, you actually can kind of fall into the flow of that experience of like, just like traveling this lonely world as this guy and just like going from place to place. There's like something to that that I think is cool. I do think it wears out its welcome pretty quickly, but I think there is something to that. So there's something with that part of the game too.
So you're saying it's a walking simulator.
It's walking.
100%.
Getting stuck on things. It's taking really shitty motorbikes and crashing them and all that stuff and building and all that. So if you don't like that kind of stuff, yeah, I don't think you'd enjoy the game, but I think there is something there that I didn't expect. I expected it to be miserable and it didn't seem that way at all times. At times it did seem miserable, but not all the time. And there's some really bad writing in this game. Like there's some exceptionally bad lines that like, I hate the word cringe, but there are parts I was literally like tensing up in pain. listening to some of the lines that Kojima put in this game. That said, though, there's some really good stuff in the story. Like, there's some things he does do that just hit really well, and a lot of that is just the presentation and the direction and the performances they have. They have a lot of good actors in this.
Right.
So, there's some good moments in there. but yeah, Death Stranding.
Yeah. And yeah, with Jedi Fallen Order, I just, you know, would see a bunch of stuff about it. It's like, okay, I'll just go play Sekiro instead. Thanks. Bye.
Yeah, no, fair enough. It's for me, like, obviously I love Star Wars, so it's right. It's a good experience, a good Star Wars game. But in the meantime, we'll go ahead and jump into our roundtable for this one, which will be the best games of the decade. So any game that was released since January 1, 2010 up to the end of this year is fair game. And we're just going to kind of talk about some of our favorite games over that period and why we like them so much personally, but also kind of situate their importance, perhaps. Not everyone's obligated to do this, but if you want to, their importance in the general history of video games. You know, it was a pretty big year for video games. A lot has changed in this year in terms of how games are made and what games are seen as important. So that kind of stuff is fun to talk about. Does anyone want to start us off?
Decade.
You mean decade. Yeah, decade. Said year.
All 10 of them. All 10 of those years.
Yes, nice.
Been a long time.
Yep.
Yeah, so does anyone want to start us off?
I'll do it.
Yeah,
go ahead. All right. So the first one I was going to talk about was Telltale's The Walking Dead that came out in 2012. And mostly because I find that like Telltale is such a fascinating studio with such an interesting
was.
Yeah, an interesting, it has an interesting history and then an eventual interesting downfall that was, you know, very tragic for everyone who worked at that studio. But when this game first came out, I was trying to remember if there was anything that, like, had done an episodic format like this. Or at least, like, if there had been, I don't think anything had been this popular that was episodically released. That definitely had an influence, I think, on the industry, where, like, I think this directly, like, is the reason why Life is Strange was episodic. And other games have sort of picked up that format and realized that that's actually, like, a viable way to release your content. But, like, this was Telltale's first... I think they'd done some, like, other games before this that were very, very different, but this was, like, their first big, big hit. And I think it was well-deserved, because I really loved this game when it came out. I was really genuinely moved by it, as I think a lot of people were. And I think, like... Obviously, like, the studio, I think, became very maligned because it became very transparent, I think, of how all these games were fairly similar, and that the, as much as they pushed the idea that your choices matter, like, as in any video game, your choices are cul-de-sac, right? Like, a lot of times you're, unless you're, like, doing something like Fallout New Vegas, where you just have, like, a weird, insane amount of ways to approach a situation, in a game like this, you're really presented with a binary choice, and both of them sort of, like, there's some textural differences in how things play out, but ultimately you're reaching the same conclusion no matter what you choose. But despite that, like, I feel like almost every game that released, I really, really liked, and I really liked playing, and I liked making those choices, even knowing that a lot of times they didn't actually matter. They always, I think, did a lot of good work making those moments feel impactful and making me stop and consider what I was going to do. And, like, The Walking Dead was, like, it was a well-told story, and I feel that way about almost every game. Almost, I feel like some of them were real rough, but, like, looking at their catalog, you know, The Wolf Among Us is one of my favorite games ever. I just love, I really love the experience of playing that game. I liked the Game of Thrones Telltale, as weird as it was, sort of, sometimes, Iron from Ice. Tales of the Borderlands was really, really excellent, and the Batman games, especially the second season. The second season was, like, one of the first Telltale games, I feel like, where they took a lot of the criticisms about the choice mechanic and actually took it to heart, because, like, the final episode of that season was, I think, actually had a lot of really interesting deviations from... compared to, like, some of the former games where sort of things ended up in the same place, that one I felt like had a lot of nuance in how things could pan out. And also, again, just told, like, a really emotional, like, and weirdly homoerotic story about Batman and Joker. Yeah, I was wondering what other people, like, how they felt about Telltale in general, because I don't have a lot of negative feelings, actually. I feel like people's attitudes towards the studio really soured, and... Like, even a game, like, I felt like the third season of The Walking Dead was really, really bad. And that just because it just did not have a good story behind it and felt sort of heartless and was not compassionate with its characters. But again, like, there were moments in that were genuinely, like, there's a big moment towards the end of that game that I actually felt was, like, as far as, like, creating a moment of choice that feels meaningful, like, actually kind of, like, punched me in the chest a little. Like, it was well delivered. So I'm interested in what, like, how other people, like, what their attitudes were towards the studio, if they liked these games, if they just found them tiresome.
Well, I think so. I mean, these games are very important. You know, when the first Walking Dead came out, it was sort of, there wasn't anything else like it, right, at that time. And I think that they created genre in itself. In industry, I think the main problem a lot of people have with the studio is that their formula almost never changed. It's kind of like the same thing over and over and over again. It's sort of like you take one franchise and you just do the exact same thing, and everything sort of just, it became homogenous over time. I don't know if everybody else had that same problem.
I didn't play enough of them to ever get tired of them. You know, every time I've, like, stepped into those games, I've always really enjoyed it. I just, I never really completed kind of any of the seasons. It's mainly just a problem with I haven't always had the greatest computer to play video games on, and so I kind of sour on stuff just for that fact. But it's one of those things where I really that's another one of those like games and series that I need to give more attention to, because I really enjoyed, you know, all that I saw of it, and obviously never got repetitive for me because I didn't go through everything.
Sure.
So yeah, Zach can go on.
Sure. Yeah, I'm kind of the same. Embarrassingly, the only Telltale game that I played to completion was the Game of Thrones game. I've played, I think, a little bit of most of them. I've played the first season of Walking Dead, I've played the first episode of The Wolf Among Us, and I've played the first episode of Tales from the Borderlands. I've watched the first episode of the first season of the Batman one. And yeah, I think the first thing to say is, like, I don't think we quite appreciate enough how much better storytelling got in games over this decade. Yeah. And I think that Telltale was probably the primary force, at the very least one of the main forces that pushed that forward. Like, if you look back at some of the games that came before the stuff they were putting out, they just didn't have the same level of depth and detail to them in terms of the story and the ways they were constructed and the characters were constructed. Mm-hmm. And of course, there are games that directly follow that formula and still do. Like, for me, like, my ideal version of a Telltale-style game was Life is Strange. Like, I love that game. And I think just the fact that the story it was telling and the characters it had, I think I was just personally more interested in it, and that's why I enjoyed it more than some of the Telltale stuff I played. But there is something important there, but at the same time, I do think what you're saying, Bing, makes sense. Like, the fact that this formula just kind of got stale, it wasn't evolved enough over the course of the decade, and that's partially, I think, why, and there's a ton of reasons. You can go read, like, the article on why Telltale fell apart and a lot of its internal stuff. But as far as, like, the outside perception of the quality of the games themselves, I think they did kind of fall out of favor over the course of the decade because of the fact that it felt like, both visually in terms of, like, the engine and all that stuff, it didn't feel like there was a lot of progress there, but also just it felt like they were kind of taking the same approach with the actual storytelling and the approach to the characters and everything with the games themselves. So I get that. I think that makes sense. But I think that we still do have to appreciate the things they added, and I think all those games are still really good. And I'm glad they existed, and I think that they were significant for this decade and for gaming in general.
Yeah, I think, like, at least, like, this, like, Walking Dead was, like, the first time I think I noticed the term season pass, like, in terms, and I'm pretty sure they invented that, or at least they popularized it to where, I think, like, Bioshock Infinite came out not long after that, and they were like, buy your season's pass for the content that we're never going to deliver to you. You know? I think it invented sort of, like, this idea of, like, false promises that, or at least, like, a poor returns for something, like, where you pay a lot of money forward and you're not necessarily getting a lot back as they stagger out content over the course of, like, a year or 2 years. I just found out, actually, that, like, the final season of The Walking Dead, which is what studio was working on when it foreclosed, they actually finished that, like, another studio actually finished that, which makes me excited because I didn't play it. I will just say that, like, I do agree that, like, visual, like, the graphically, the games, like, very rarely change. They got a little more nuanced, I think, and just, like, because it was always, like, the same style, but I think, like, it did, some of it graphically improved, but it never changed, like, it never evolved, and I think that's fair. I've never had, before or since, like, the studio, never had an experience where, like, a new episode of a season would drop, and I would just know, I would, like, make myself a root beer float, I would turn all the lights out, and it's like, for the next 2 hours, I'm just going to play through this chapter. And it felt, like, really good to have that serialized experience with a video game, of not just, like, I'm going to sit down and, like, plow through 13 hours of this game because I need to finish it on this weekend before I go back to work. It was more like, okay, I can count on the story continuing next month and the month after, and I'm always going to have this one chunk of time where I see how things pan out. And it was just, it was really fun, and it was really unique, and I have a lot of affection for those games that I think outweigh any criticism I have of the studio.
Sure. It was like watching TV, but better.
Totally.
Yeah, it's a really good analog with the conversation that's actually happening right now between, like, a binge watch show, the kind of formula or model that Netflix uses, or the episodic weekly format that most shows have used over history, but also, like, HBO uses now. And I think we've seen over time the trend has started to shift actually back toward weekly releases because of the fact that it does create an ongoing experience that everyone can share together, and it kind of builds momentum over that period of time. And it's also just nice, like you say, Katie, to just look forward to something, to look forward to the next chapter in something. I think there's just something cool about that, and that's an experience I've had as well with those kind of episodic games. I think some games have kind of taken it to an extreme that I don't like. Like Final Fantasy VII, which is coming out next year, is going to have an episodic quote-unquote release. But I suspect their episodic quote-unquote is going to be like one this year and one 3 years later. Like that's just not – that's a bad way to piecemeal your game. And I think it's just because they just don't have the – they really or announced it too early, and they just have to release what they have now. And I think there's some concerns with that. Take on it, but I think the things that Telltale have done and the things that other companies that have emulated them have done of having a release every few months makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. I know there's one like Kentucky Route Zero. That was a game that I've meant to play for a long time, but the last episode of that game has been like on hiatus for like 5 years. So. I'm going to wait until that hopefully comes out before I play it.
Going on a couple points that we've mentioned here. I will say this game's kind of influence and overall storytelling, especially when it comes to the types of games I play, story is a very important part of how I judge them overall. Mm-hmm. So I definitely like this game for its influences on that. Although I am one of the people that 95% of the time I think shows should just be dropped all at once. I don't really do the episodic stuff. I think most stories, most long form stories that are overall, season long stories are just better when you can do them at your own pace, like you would a book. But
it's definitely pros and cons to each approach. It's harder and harder, I think, as you get older to like just jump into a really long thing. Like it's just harder to get in. So like having this kind of like bite sized chunk is nice for that as well. So there's something to that too, I think.
Sure. I will say, probably the best Walking Dead anything in that franchise.
Wow, that's a bold claim.
I agree.
That's probably fair.
All right, we can move on, unless anyone else has some more thoughts on that one.
I can go with mine.
Okay.
I was waffling between Undertale and Stardew Valley. Because they both kind of represent kind of a similar thing to me in the anti big studio tentpole games, sort of instead the opposite of the game that's made by a single person.
So crazy, right?
And the ones that sort of using limited resources to do the best that they can, sort of stretch out to sort of push the boundaries of what video games can do. I think I'm still going with Undertale. Even though I have talked a lot about Undertale before. So I mean, I'm not going to go focus on the story, but it is kind of amazing how much they were able to do with essentially RPG. What is it? RPG Maker.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
The thing about Undertale is how it's able to use all aspects of the game to tell a story.
Yeah.
It's not reliant on a single gameplay mechanism. Without Undertale, now you wouldn't have a bunch of these loads of these indie darling games that has come out since its release. It has become sort of a genre on its own. And one thing that it shares with games like Stardew Valley or also even stuff like, I don't know, anybody play Doki Doki Literature Club?
I have watched like 5 playthroughs and it disturbs me greatly every time.
Yeah. Especially Undertale and Doki Doki Literature, there's also that sort of the viral quality to that.
Right.
And the way in which you can stuff that you don't think you can use, like turning the game off on its own, going messing around with the game files, digging that deep to actually tell a story in game,
and you as the player being addressed directly by the game, which is of course unsettling, but also it's a mm-hmm. unique and cool idea.
Yeah, there's a very meta quality to that, and I know some people don't like that, and don't like the fact that, but it pushes, to me, it's really exciting that then you have games like this that push the boundary of what a video game can do, and to use all aspects of the game, even the game file, even the codes that make the game itself, to be part of this whole experience. And I feel like the big companies, it's over time, as these big companies got more and more repetitive in the things they're doing. And all these tentpole games are becoming to look more and more alike. The onus of innovation is actually be much more in these sort of, indie games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's that thing that happens in any industry, right? Where they become more and more homogenized as they see like a specific kind of thing that can sell. It's kind of up to the solo creators, like you talk about, to innovate, to carry the torch of progress. And I think the key thing that you mentioned that I love in games, and it's something that I constantly look for, and to use the fancy word for it, like the idea of a ludonarrative, where the gameplay itself is part of the story. The gameplay and the story are working together to say something. It's not just like you're going to shoot up a level of bad guys and then you're in a cutscene where the story is for 10 minutes. Like, it's not that kind of separation. They are tied together in such a strong way. Like that, for me, that is when games become art, to use the word that is so contentious. Like that is the highest idealized version of a game when it can do that effectively. And Undertale is a great version of that. I think so much of the story is built on this kind of emotional element to it, and this idea of kind of breaking against the convention of a game, which is you go in the place, you kill all the monsters, you do that thing. And this game tries to, you know, with strenuous difficulty, you have to learn how to not do that. And something comes across in the effort, the trials of that gameplay that carries the message of the story and the themes of that game across. And I think it wouldn't work without both of those sides at the highest level.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that your choices on either of those sides really completely changes the story, not just the story, but how the game feels. If you follow one path, the pacifist path, it's much more like a coming to age story. Whereas the other path is a horror game.
Yes. God, it's so scary.
Yeah.
And you're the scary.
Yeah. Yeah. To a point. And I think there's a lot of mischaracterization of these separate paths as some sort of the video game being like moralizing about what's good and what's bad. I don't think that was the intention of Toby Fox, the creator. I think the Genocide Route is actually probably the better game, especially with the mechanisms that they use. And I think other than the fact that I know that I can never beat it. I think overall, actually, the better experience is in the Genocide Route.
Yeah, we've talked about all the reasons why this game is so brilliant. But just to reiterate on some of that stuff, just the idea of, I don't know, just the idea of all the aspects of it, like we said, just of course the gameplay, the storytelling, and the music, and the presentation, and everything that creates such a powerful emotional effect. Like this was like the story of this game on both sides of it. Created such high highs of emotions that I haven't experienced. Like this was on my list too of consideration, just because of this, because it genuinely has a message to share, and it has an emotional impact. Like it's so hard to make you feel anything with a game, with a movie, with a TV show, and this game does that, and it has a message about determination and pushing past obstacles, and it's something that's just done so well, and it's in a package you just wouldn't expect all that to happen, but it does. So it's cool, and it's special for sure. I want to say also, I just want to talk about Stardew Valley for a second.
Sure. Okay.
Just to say, like, this game too, obviously for the reasons you said, like just it being a creation of one person, and I think like you mentioned at the beginning, I think, and it's true of both games, like I think constraints are beautiful, right? Like I think limited materials, limited resources, all these things are kind of what makes things special. Like this is something that's said about like the original Star Wars films, like the fact that such a hellish production kind of is what made them good, compared to the more controlled environment and the more resources, of course, they had when they released like the prequels and whatnot. So yeah, like, I think constraints make things special, and I think that's true of Undertale and Stardew Valley, which, like, I look for this kind of game everywhere. Like, one of my favorite games as a kid was Animal Crossing, and yeah, it's the same kind of thing where, like, you just, like, get to fall into this world and be, like, a farmer. Like, there's just something, like, there are times in your life where you just, like, need to have something that's relaxing and yeah, meditative like that. Like, I want to go play it again right now. Like, I need Stardew Valley right now. You know?
Yeah, well, and the thing is, it's much more than that. There's more and more game to it, and as you keep playing.
It's true, yes.
And I really feel like what this, because they were so limited, that's what pushes creativity.
Agreed, yeah. Both such good games. Both games I actually wanted to include really badly. All right, Matt, do you want to hit us with your first pick?
Sure. And I'm gonna start off with caveats and kind of explanation of my process here. So number one, no Soulsborne, as we've talked about enough on these casts. But it is my favorite series of the decade, and obviously Sekiro is my favorite game this year, but we've talked about it enough. Number two, I don't own a Switch, so Odyssey and Breath of the Wild are off the table. And finally, number three, kind of in trying to narrow these games down, you know, when you have to go from a list of like 15 down to two or three, you know, the final cuts are just kind of more personal than anything else. And so it really just comes with, what type of game I enjoy the most. And so even though, like, I definitely played a lot of good indie games over the course of the past decade, I think kind of the two that stand out to me are Hollow Knight and Darkest Dungeon. And kind of picking a top two or three, they're all going to be, you know, 60 plus hour single player RPG action adventure games. And with the exception of, you know, my favorite game of the decade, they're almost all like big studio and like the third or fourth game in the series. Because I tend to prefer, polished mechanics of like later games in the series over like the innovation of the first couple games. And so there's, you know, there's a lot of that with Witcher 3, Skyrim, Fallout 4, stuff like that. And they also happen to be kind of my intro into each of those series. And so it's just kind of, you know, if I go from those and then trying to go back to the older games that aren't as polished and the graphics aren't as good, it's not something I like to do. I much prefer playing the later games. All right. So with all that said, my top pick is The Last of Us. It was, when you first suggested this topic, it immediately was the one that was the obvious choice for me. It just blends everything I want in a game. And so, yeah, so it's, you know, it's a long form storytelling. It's a long game. You know, it has RPG elements. It has really good stealth mechanics. And it has a very impactful, story and ending that I just love. And then, in combination with the voice acting and between Troy and Ashley, it's just kind of everything I wanted, and I cannot wait for the sequel to come out next year.
It's definitely one of the best endings, like, one of the best, like, final.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
One of the best just final lines and final moments and then credits. Like, it's so...
Yep.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing that I most strongly associate with that game. Because I never went... I played it once and I never went back to it, even though I did have fun and I did enjoy the... some of the difficulty of navigating, what are they called? Clickers? Like, bug people, fungus people.
Yep.
But yeah, I think the way that relationship culminates and the way that Joel is just this, like, nightmare, tortured, traumatized, but also deeply humanized character, like, it's truly just an excellent ending to a game.
I feel the exact same way. Like, that is also what I think about when I think of The Last of Us. Like, just from, like, a technical, like, craft standpoint, I think it is the best ending in any video game. Just the idea of, like, this shared lie that they're gonna have and just not needing to acknowledge it between them at the moment, just kind of like Ellie just nodding and saying, yeah, okay, we're going to do this. Like, it's just, it's fucking brilliant. Like, it's one of the best pieces of writing I've ever seen. Like, it's that good. So that aspect of the game, like, I absolutely love that. And there's so many moments in the game that, like we talked about with Telltale, like, this game really elevated the game with storytelling, yeah. with what is expected of a game to be able to tell a story in a powerful and moving way. So for all those reasons, like, it's gone up. It's only gone up in my estimation as I think about it more and more.
Did anybody see the video of Nolan North reacting to the scene, the opening scene the first time?
No, I never did.
So he and Troy Baker are doing a let's play of the first one of The Last of Us, and apparently that was the first time that Nolan North has ever actually saw the scene of spoiler in the opening.
Mm. I can't think of any other game that lets you play, like, the opening, like, the first hours of a zombie outbreak, like, quote-unquote zombie outbreak, and it's so well done, and, like, obviously just the way that, because I think, like, I'm not a huge fan of zombie anything, but that's always the part of, like, zombie fiction that I find the most harrowing and exciting is those first, like, few hours or days of outbreak, and, like, the claustrophobia, and just the way that it ends in the most, like, unpredictable, but at the same time, like, you're like, oh, of course, they get shot by the police as they're trying to escape America. But, yeah, it's also, like, the game, I think it also plays with one of my favorite tropes, which is just, like, of, it's like the Davos-Melisandre conflict of A Song of Ice and Fire, of, like, you know, how much is this one life worth to you in the context of all human life? And from Joel's perspective, it's everything. It's the only thing that matters. And ultimately, I think that's the right choice, but there is that ambiguity there of on some level, like, what if we, like, he's defied her choice in it. Like, he's rejected Ellie's autonomy and agency in deciding what she wanted best for the human race. And instead he's going to, like, superimpose his will over her so that he can keep her, you know, because he loves her. Like, it's, like Zach said, it's just truly excellent and exquisite character development.
Yeah, so my kind of going off that. So yeah, the kind of the best thing I can say about it was, you know, it's like playing through kind of a post-apocalyptic miniseries.
Yeah.
And I just love that aspect of it. And yeah, and then as you were saying, I mean, it's the Captain America line from Infinity War, like, we don't trade lives. And yeah, and I'm a sucker, I think. Cabin in the Woods is one that does something very similar in a really good way, where, you know, I'm a sucker for, you know, having a choice between one person and the world, and the person just says, fuck the world, I choose the one person. And it's one of those, like, concepts in storytelling that I love, that I'm a sucker for and love to read.
Yeah, I think the only reason the game kind of goes down in my estimation is just personal reasons. Like, there are some zombie apocalypse type fiction that I like, but it generally is not a setting, a framework that I personally super love. But I think of those, like, The Last of Us is obviously one of the best. It does it extremely well. Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing is too, is that, like, I just don't quite enjoy as much, like, this kind of gameplay loop, right? Like the Naughty Dog, like, shoot up sections, zombie horror survival, like, that kind of stuff, just, it's not for me. Like, that's the only reason. And I think, like, there are some things the game does where it is what we talk about, that ludonarrative thing where, like, the gameplay and the story are one. But for the most part, like, it doesn't quite have that same effect. The Last of Us, where you can totally feel the gameplay in sync with the storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, that's fair. But yeah, no, it's just like, this comes up a lot in how I judge games, as my style of play is always, you know, stealth mechanics over run and gun. And so I judge games very harshly on how well they pull that off. And right. The Last of Us does a pretty damn good job of it.
I just do not have the patience for stealth. I'm just like, I can't handle this. So that's probably part of it for sure.
Yeah, I didn't pick it because I've never played the game. I've watched I've watched the game many times by now. I've never played it.
Yeah.
It's all right. I've never played Undertale, so.
No, that's fine.
Yeah.
Everyone has their own thing.
No, it's not I didn't like it. It's just, because I watched it, I feel like I didn't need to play it anymore.
Yeah, I've watched this game in all kinds of ways, like Let's Plays and streams and stuff, but I've also watched it on the couch, watching someone else play it, like, it's enjoyable every time, and I think I do appreciate it more and more every time I do experience it. And just the characters, and like we say, like the development of that, so good, and the DLC as well, the Left Behind DLC is excellent too. Yes. Like it's really well made, and Naughty Dog just like knocks it out of the park and this kind of stuff. Like I was just played Uncharted the Lost Legacy a few months ago. Just like, again, like that game's ending, like it's not obviously on the same emotional level, but the ending was fucking brilliant too. Like they're just good. They just know what they're doing.
So, all right, a quick question on that. Cause I never picked up the Lost Legacy. Just cause I don't know. Maybe it's just the advertisement. It didn't feel like a complete game to, like, it kind of felt like the last, Dishonored game that was released, where it was almost like extended DLC.
You can say that. It's like a 5-6 hour experience maybe, and it's more Uncharted basically. The characters are different. It's
female leads, right?
Yeah, it's Chloe, and can't remember. I think it's Nadine Ross.
Nadine.
Played by Laura Bailey, and
Oh, it is Laura.
Great. Yeah. It's just another, it's more Uncharted. So if you like Uncharted, I think you'd like it. But it's only like 6 hours and it's like not blowing the socks off of anything. I think for me, like I was just surprised how good the ending was. Like the ending in particular was just really good. So I like that.
All right. Gotcha. Yeah. That's why I never, Uncharted 4 was the first one I ever played that series, and it was surprisingly really enjoyable.
Again, they just know what to do with that style of story. Like they just know how to do it the right way. And it'll be curious to see what The Last of Us 2 looks like, for sure.
Yeah.
Whenever that comes out.
Well, it's coming out April, I think.
It's in May. Yeah, May. It's in May. They officially announced it. Well, yeah, it was delayed from, like, February to May, whatever. Who cares? The one more thing I wanted to say, we kind of skipped past it, because, partway through Last of Us, you switch over when Joel gets injured, you switch over to Ellie. And that particular fight, that you have with, the rapist dude, is really good.
Is that the one when you're like sneaking around in the house?
Yeah.
In
restaurants. Yeah.
Yeah. And he like, and it, you know, it has three different fate, you know, you basically just have to sneak up on him like three times, but like, you know, he learns over the course of the fight. And so it becomes harder and harder. It's really, really good.
Yes. That's the Nolan North character.
Oh, I didn't realize Nolan played that.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
it is I remember that Ellie section being hilarious to me because she kills like 100 people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
With a bow and arrow, just like, it's no big deal.
and that's what the second game is going to be. She's going fucking hunting.
Yeah.
Can't wait. Alright, so my first game, like you said, Matt, some context and thoughts on how I picked. So of all the best games of the decade, picking one was extremely difficult for me, as I'm sure it was for all of you. When I went back and looked at all the games I played over this period, there was just like an endless amount of amazing stuff. I ended up picking about 20 games or so and whittling them down to my final two. I'm still not 100% sure if I picked the right ones, but I think these are the ones I want to talk about for this cast. So for the first one, it's tricky because I did just talk about it in the mid-year cast we did a few months ago, but I was still kind of dissatisfied with how I described this game back then, so I just like to go a little further with it and explain my reasoning for why I like it so much. So the game is Persona 5. This was released in 2017. I didn't play it then. I bought it that year, but I didn't play it. Well, I played it for about 3 hours, and I was just steamrolled by the JRPG tutorial madness of that game. I had picked it up again one or two times after that, but I still couldn't quite get over the hump. It wasn't until early this year when I found myself with a good chunk of free time that I really dove into this monstrously huge game and absolutely fell in love with it. I can point to maybe a handful of single-player game experiences I've had in my life that are just transcendently good. A lot of it's contextual. I really think there's this rare thing that happens when the right game finds you at the right time, and there's no better example of that for me than Persona 5. So we've talked about all the normal reasons why this game is so good. It has such an incredible sense of style between its visual design, its animations, and its music, all the way down to how it feels to just flip through the menus of the game. It's all so consistent and so seamless with that. That's something I look for in all kinds of media, just a piece of work that just has a strong identity to it and direction to it. And the identity of Persona 5 is overwhelmingly strong. The gameplay is probably my favorite style of gameplay in a single-player game. I love turn-based combat, and I have for basically my entire life. Persona 5 is one of the absolute best examples of that gameplay loop, and it is challenging, and it's gratifying to learn the systems in the game in and out, which, again, I look for so much in games. Many of the bosses early on couldn't simply be steamrolled with power. I had to think through what my strategy was and use every member of my team in just the right way to overcome them. But the most important thing is the story, and it's the characters. I'm not going to claim that Persona 5 has the best written characters or the most thoughtful story of any game I've played this decade. Definitely not. But what it does have are characters that you can't help but genuinely fall in love with and grow more and more attached to over the 100 hours of playing it. It has a story that to me has a very clear message and is actually packed with so many themes that are handled so well. On the surface, this game is about rebellion and the dangers of conformity in an increasingly technologized world where it's so easy to just get on the train, put on your mask, and look down at your phone again and again and again. And that's a consistent image that runs through the game. It's a game about, I think, embracing your flaws, making those your power or your armor, as Tyrion would say. Every character in this game is looking to redeem themselves in some fashion for so many varied and unique reasons that are all easily relatable to all kinds of different people. And I think most importantly, it's a game about how harmful it is to repress who you are when society wants you to be someone else. And it's a game about how painful but fulfilling it can be to rip off the mask and just be the person you want to be. And I think that's such an important thing, and it's handled with such grace in this game. And again, I think it's contextual and unique to the circumstances where I played this, but when I was experiencing the ending of this game and just being there to live through the last few moments I'd have with these characters, it was just so satisfying and perfect. I think, like we've talked about, endings are incredibly difficult, particularly achieving this kind of effect that I mentioned. And Persona 5 does it. The sense of satisfaction and even sense of loss, knowing that I won't get to hang out with these characters again, is what I look for everywhere, constantly, in any piece of media. So for all those reasons, I put it up here as one of the best of the decade. It was special for me, and I'll always remember this game. So, yeah, that's my reasons for this one.
It's easily like the most playable, I think, of the latter day Personas. Obviously just yes. by the brunt of, you know, being new. I think I've said this before, like 3 is my favorite, but it's really a tough game to go back to. 4 is very good, but 5 I think is like there's just something about it. And I think what I like the most about it is the situation that it puts the protagonist in early on, which is that he is essentially a victim of an unjust, I don't even know what, like an unjust situation. Like he has been blamed for something that is not in any way his fault and is now being very unfairly, like, treated very brutally by the adults in his life. And there's basically nothing that he can do to retaliate. And you feel that very keenly of like, okay, I did a good thing. I'm being punished for it. And my reputation is ruined. I'm a bad kid. Everyone's going to treat me like a bad kid. And there's something, I think, very awesome about what feels like in the game, like this sort of bucket, like saying basically, okay, well, if I'm a bad kid, well, fuck you. I know I'm not a bad kid, but that means I don't have
I'll be bad.
Yeah, I'll be bad in my own way that actually is doing good. Yes. But in the end, like that ending is so, it feels like a reprieve. It's like you've done it. Like you've gotten out. Right? Like, it felt like you were going to be in this horrible place forever, but, you know, you're with your friends now, and it's in the past. Like, there's something very deft about that that is, like, I think hard for me to put into words, but I did feel very touched by the ending. It felt, I don't know, like, something, because I do feel like a lot of the stuff that you go through when you're a teenager feels like it's going to be, like, you were condemned there for eternity, and when you realize that, no, there is actually a better life ahead of you, that it, I don't know, that it was, I felt really moved by the ending, like you said, Zach. I did have some problems with, like, the final
battle. It has a lot of problems.
Yeah, the final battle I felt like ridiculous. Yeah. I think that's a 5-hour battle.
I was going to mention the gay stereotypes.
Oh, yeah.
We talked about that, yeah.
Yeah, we were talking about that, yeah.
That's definitely a problem.
Which is disappointing given some of the themes I talked about. Like, it's disappointing that in some ways they just don't acknowledge that. So,
yeah.
It's tough.
Two things about Persona 5. I think one thing is a lot of the messages, which I think still comes across pretty and pretty directly to people here in the US, but I think some of the things speaks even stronger to the context in Japan today. Yes. All the palace the big bosses in all the main villains in the story, they're all based on actual people. In Japan in recent years, actual controversies, and speaking to a very unique problem in Japanese society today, not just an aging population, but population that's increasing, that has a group of young people that's increasingly becoming apathetic.
Yes.
Towards, anything, like, beyond their daily lives. And this trend towards avoiding controversy and avoiding trouble as much as possible to the extreme that, that really, really horrible things just get swept under the rug. There's a lot of talk about how the Me Too movement, had very minimal effect in Japan. Even despite the fact we've been hearing all these different crazy stories about sexual harassment especially in the entertainment industry in Japan. How the biggest music company, the idol company in Japan, who's the founder of the company was a known pedophile and nothing was ever done to him for 20, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's speaking directly much more to these sort of issues. And also this idea of this generation of young people, because they can't fit in to certain stereotypes of how you should behave. They increasingly feel like they're marginalized from society and they have no power whatsoever.
That half of it, and just the idea of being kind of, and this is what Katie described, that your character goes through at the start of the game, is feeling like you are isolated and kind of alone in the world. And that is something that I think from my understanding is very true of Japanese culture right now for young people. But I think it's something that is increasingly true of all people. That's just increasing isolation and loneliness that's so easy to happen in the world we live in. And it's kind of incredible that, like, all these things you mentioned, and also this idea that I do think is one of the reasons the ending is so strong, is because it does feel like you have kind of found your tribe, found your pack of misfits, whatever you want to call it, at the end. And you felt like you, as you said, Katie, you've overcome all these circumstances. But it's so amazing that, like, this game that's ostensibly like an anime game or whatever can have such resonance and relevance to these modern issues, and like in such a deft way, like in such an effective way that doesn't, in some aspects of it are kind of blunt, but for the most part, like, it's able to just communicate this stuff in the way it presents itself to you.
I will say there is a scene, because all the bosses are like all the authority figures that you take down, I think almost all of them are guilty of like abusing young people in some way.
Yep.
And the first like boss is the coach at the high school, and obviously like it escalates, it gets very, very extreme, but I feel like there's a very good scene like early on when you first meet Anne, who's the first female companion that you pick up, and the coach comes up and asks if she wants a ride, and she very cheerfully says, yeah, of course, and she gets in the car, and you just see her face as the car pulls away, and she is clearly not okay, even though she got in the car willingly. Like, this is a complicated situation where someone with a lot of power is obviously applying pressure on people who don't have a lot of power. Which to me that moment feels very honest, and I really like Anne as a character. I just wish it feels a little dissonant than the way the game treats her body. And you know, treats her as a sexual object in a way where the narrative seems to, at least in her story, seems to rebuke that very strongly. But then again, obviously that's a problem, I think, a lot of the genre.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I feel like the best story in Persona is probably the way you dealt with depression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With Futaba's story. I think that was the most unique, section of the main story. It stands out from any other palace in that story. And I think that's the one in which they're most consistent about, in terms of the message.
other than that moment with Anne, like, one of the moments that just, like, killed me in that game and felt really honest is when she is, like, she's been in her, like, trapped in her room for, like, almost a year, and she just has this moment of deep self-awareness where she's like, I'm gonna die in here, which, like, like, that was, like, a knife to my heart, because it's, like, I feel like anyone who's been, like, in the throes of mental illness or deep depression, it's like being in a cage, and it's like, I don't know how to get out, and I feel like my future is a closed door. Like, you feel helpless, and, like, that character is deeply sympathetic, and, like, every other person in the game has been misused by society. But, yeah, her storyline was very, very strong.
I think it's where the game kind of elevates the concept of the change of heart, where earlier on it's, like, this tool to get those evil people to confess the things they've done. But here it is actually someone, you know, working to kind of overcome something in themselves in a very positive way. Mm. And I think that that was just such a smart progression of that theme and that concept. And it works so well there, and it's something that I think carries from there through the rest of the game.
Persona Royal coming out, already came out. Coming out next year globally.
I might play it. It actually doesn't sound that great to me in terms of the stuff it adds, but I might just want to play this game again.
more catchy.
Yeah.
Yeah, true.
And that new girl, red hair girl.
Yeah, we'll see. Matt, you played this recently. Is there anything you want to add on this before we move on?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that, I mean, like, I bought it within maybe a week of when you guys bring it up on the last cast. And yeah, no, I absolutely loved it. It's one of the best turn-based RPGs I've ever played. And yeah, no, it was just a blast to play. You guys did a good job of praising it here. Yeah, my only complaint is that there were a couple of, end game stuff that, by nature of the story and style of the game, that they weren't easy to access. I wish I could have just had a thing, you know, after the game to just kind of go back into the world and hit level 100, get all the best items and fight like the couple of, two final bosses in it.
Yeah, on that side of it, but also the social side, like, it's almost impossible to max out your confidants and see the full story of every character on a new game playthrough. Unless you're like me, or like Matt, or I think like Bing too, where like we like super maximize everything.
I didn't use the playthrough, but I did know that, two characters are very, two confidant rods are very important and makes everything else much easier.
Oh, yeah, for sure. The fortune teller is huge.
Fortune teller.
And the teacher as well. They're both very important.
I was legitimately, I had about like three different guides I was following and just kind of.
No, I'm the same.
Like, yeah. I was using them and combining them into like the best, like, optimized thing I could figure out.
I gotta get the smoothie on Sunday. That's a free action. Gotta make sure to get the stat bonus there. And I gotta make sure to go to the bathhouse on Monday to get the bonus there. Cause that's a higher value cause it's an herbal bath, you know?
I will say this. It's much easier to do compared to Persona 4.
Right, yeah. I know that, yeah. But that's just a fun part of it, too. If you're that kind of person, I do enjoy that kind of, like, min-maxy element as well.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, no, it was part of the fun. Because, yeah, I was trying to, like, figure out ways to make the guides, like, better and, like, more applicable to, like, the characters I liked better. So
there you go. All right, cool. That will round us out for our first group of games. Katie, do you want us to take us through the second half, the second picks?
Sure. I debated between Gone Home and Journey. Both are really, like, indie games that I liked a lot, and I feel like were kind of watershed moments for the industry. But I think I'm going to go with Gone Home, just because it feels a little more personal. It came out in 2013, and it was... I don't think it was the first game like this, but I think it was the first game that I feel like got a lot of attention as a quote-unquote walking simulator, and a lot of, like, really absurd conversation about, like, is this actually a video game? Mostly from people who were homophobic and did not like that it succeeded as well as it did. But yeah, I mean, the game, obviously, like, you're playing as a sister who is coming home, and it almost starts out like a horror game, because it's like you've come home to your house, your family is gone, the circumstances of what has happened are unclear, and you're basically wandering around your abandoned home, investigating and trying to figure out what has gone down here, and you as the player, like, putting together, like, the history of the house and the history of the family and the story, and ultimately finding out that, you know, like, the younger sister has been isolated and ostracized and rejected by her family for being gay, And for me at the time, like, when this game came out, like, there wasn't, like, there were definitely, like, LGBT characters in games and, like, BioWare games and stuff, but I couldn't think of many games where, that were focused on LGBT themes like this. Like, it was very pointedly, it wasn't just, like, an incidental character who happened to be queer. It was like, no, this is about a very universal queer experience, which is the pain of family rejection and also the threat that your family can have to your own, you know, mental health and well-being. And so for me, like, this game was very personal. And I remember feeling, like, a lot of anxiety about it because it was definitely targeted by Gamergate. Remember Gamergate, guys?
Oh, yeah.
That was a thing. Uh-huh. That was a thing that happened. And I guess those assholes are still around somewhere, but
They are definitely around.
Yeah. I guess, like, as someone who was in the closet at the time, anything that was very pointedly queer that came out, I should also say that I live in the South, and so a lot of the, like, I feel like this takes place in, like, kind of, like, not, maybe not rural Oregon, but definitely not, like, urban Oregon. And so for me, like, anything that was very pointedly about a focused queer story gave me anxiety just because it's like, I don't want to deal with the backlash. Like, I don't want to see, it's painful to, like, have a game like this come out and then see it being, you know, targeted by bigots, right? And so I think I avoided this game for a very long time, before I eventually played it, just because it just gave me a lot of, like, existential anxiety about, like, I don't need to see hateful people, like, talking about this. But yeah, like, I found it moving, and I also found it just, like, an important part of, like, it's weird to, like, talk about 2003 was not that long ago, but in some ways it feels forever ago, like, was a very important, I think, queer game that came out, but also, I think, very important as, like, almost like a new genre of games that were becoming very popular at the time, which was, like, investigation stories of, like, there's not a lot of action. It's mostly just you exploring a space and putting together a story through context clues, which is a kind of game that I like a lot. Firewatch is another game that is, like, basically a walking simulator that I think tells a very powerful story, and it's all based through, like, exploring an environment and, like, interacting with objects in the environment that does not necessarily lead to, encounters with anyone. Like, in both Gone Home and in Firewatch, you're basically alone. In Firewatch, there's a character, like, there are other characters, but they're either voices or, like, distant shadowy figures that you never, like, that don't, are not, personalized in any way. So yeah, this game was important to me and important in a lot of other ways, and yeah, it was a moving experience.
Yeah, I played this game back in 2013, and it did end up being my favorite game of that year for a lot of the reasons that you outlined there. Like, I think it was the first game I played where it had that kind of gameplay approach where it is you in this environment having to slowly kind of put the puzzle pieces together of the story and the characters of the people living in the home. Like, I just loved that experience of, like, going from this room to that room and reading the letters about dad, who's, like, a failed writer, and about mom, who's, like, having an affair or something like that. Like, or at least, like, moving in that direction, and just, like, slowly putting that story together in a non-linear fashion. Like, I was blown away by that at the time. I thought that was such a cool way to tell a story. In terms of setting it up with context clues and not, like, giving you, like, the this happened and that happened and that happened. And it's like the environment that you're in, this house, is the story. And that's just so cool. And I love, too, about how, like, this was the thing, like, I was expecting, like you said, when I'm going into it. I thought it was going to be like a horror game, right? Like, it's staged like a horror game. You're in this creepy house, and there's even stuff in the story, like the sister and her friend that end up having the relationship at the end are, like, looking for a ghost of the great-great-grandfather who lived in the house or something like that. And there's moments where, like, the lights go out suddenly, and you think you're going to turn around and see a ghost or whatever, but it never happens. And that was something that I thought was so, like, so cool. Like, you keep expecting, like, the horrific thing to happen, but it never does, and it's just like you in a house, like, that's it. And I thought that was just a revelatory thing at the time, to just not go for the twist or the cool thing at the end, and just tell a really powerful story about two characters learning to love each other. Like I just thought, like, at the end when I reached that part where you go up into the attic and you just put together everything, like, it was powerful. It was really powerful stuff. And I think that, you know, we talk about, like, walking simulators and all this stuff, but I think this game, like, it was able to tell a story that I haven't seen in other games. And I think part of it is because of the way it was constructed with that.
In a way, it is a horror game, but fair, yeah, yeah. It's not, it ends well, which I think, like, I guess there are horror game, like horror things that end well, but yeah, I mean, it's a lot about, I think, like the claustrophobia of feeling like you're not safe in your own home and mm-hmm. because of your family, and ultimately realizing that you have to get out of the haunted house. Like, your family are the monsters, and they're keeping you trapped in this life that is not you, and you have to get out.
It's not a traditional monster. There's no ghost like that.
Yeah.
It's more nuanced than that.
And ultimately, like you said, it ends well.
Yes, which is always nice.
Yeah.
I just love that part. So Matt and Bing, what are your thoughts on this, like, idea of walking simulators and this is a concept?
I mean, I tend to get bored with them after a while. I think walking simulators are ones that I like to watch on YouTube more than actually play. I do appreciate, like, the really good ones, the stories that they can tell with them. But I don't know.
Yeah, I think it is a derogatory term, right? Because it assumes that all there is to the gameplay is walking and reading. Like, and that's really not the case. Like, maybe with Gone Home you could say that, and I don't personally think so, because like I said, it feels like a puzzle. It feels like I have to, like, go from room to room and figure out the pieces. Like, I feel like I'm doing something active there. It doesn't feel like I'm on a conveyor belt leading towards a conclusion. So for me, like, it still counts as a game because of that, because I have to drive the narrative and figure these things out. Like, there's something special about taking the time to read the right things and figure everything out. Like, I feel like that's a game to me. And a lot of these games that have come after, like, one I played this year, actually, What Remains of Edith Finch, like, which is, again, ostensibly a walking simulator, has so many cool concepts with its gameplay that I do think elevate the story it's telling. Like, it can have this kind of stuff, but also still be a game to me.
Yeah, I think it's very much a case-by-case basis type thing. This is actually, this was the only game, like, mentioned in our, like, discussion I'd never heard of before. I don't know how I missed it or whatever. So I just kind of like looked it up just to see what it was about. And yeah, I think that's the main concept with the quote unquote walking simulators, where you have to feel like you're doing something. And kind of the aspect of investigation and figuring out the puzzle is something that I would very much enjoy. That's type of things. You know, I just saw Knives Out recently. I really like,
I saw the movie too.
Yeah, I really like mysteries and whodunits, so that's something I would very much enjoy. But yeah, so, you know, it's a case by case thing, where is this really the best way to, if you have to ask yourself if this is the best way to experience, you know, that type of story versus a TV show or a novel. But I think the investigation aspect of Gone Home makes it, very good and appropriate for the medium.
One could say that Journey is the ultimate walking simulator. Not to, like, monopolize too much time, but I do think Journey is just worth noting as being, like, a beautiful game that was, like, I think the first indie game that I ever played, and really set the bar for me and what my expectations were thereafter, and was really unique in how it paired you up with a companion, and how, like, there's a lot of, like, seamlessness in the fact that you think a lot of the times that you're with the same person throughout the game, and then you'll get to the end and they're like, you were matched with like 7 different people. Because obviously people drop out of the server all the time, but you know, sometimes you would get lucky and you would be with the same dude for the entire journey. I will say that, like, the very first time I completed the game, I got to the end and there's this moment where you're on the final cliff and there's like a lot of sand and you can draw things in the sand, which I don't think the developers maybe anticipated, but for my companion, I drew a smiley face, like, oh, we did it, and he drew a dick, like, I was like, all right, see ya, I'm glad that we've reached enlightenment together, asshole.
Perfect. That's so good. Yeah, I love Journey. Like, I think it's one of the most brilliant games I've ever played because of this specific thing that you talked about with the indirect kind of multiplayer, where you get paired up with this person who is just a random person that just randomly goes into your game, and you work together in weird ways to just, like, progress things, and you can't interact directly, and that's what makes it cool, is, like, because so many games, multiplayer games, are naturally so toxic, right? Like, when you can communicate with other people, you tend to say mean things. Like, that's just what happens in a lot of these multiplayer games. So the fact that you can't talk directly, outside of drawing dicks, it creates this kind of weird relationship that's really powerful and something that I love to see in games, and that I think a game like Nier Automata also does this extremely well. Like, I think that's such a cool thing in games and something I want to see more and more of. All right, Bing, next game for you.
Yeah, I've thought about talking about one of the many strategy games that I play, but in the end, I feel like those are all just iterations, new iterations of games I had already been playing in the 2000s. So it doesn't feel like too different. So I chose Witcher 3. Yeah, so I don't play a lot of these open world RPGs. Well, definitely not as much as I used to. I have not played any Assassin's Creed games since I think the second one. Yeah, I haven't been playing, I don't know, whatever, I haven't been playing any Fallouts. But The Witcher 3, I think it's, what it does much better than any of those is that it makes you feel like all of your side quests are worth it. That every single one of these side quests is a story in itself. And that you actually really are living in a living world. I think it's very important. I mean, The Witcher is based upon a novel series that's centered around the character of Geralt of Rivia. And I think it's actually very important that they put you into the boots of this established character. You don't need to even imagine too much to feel like you're part of that world when you're in Geralt's boots. That he's someone that has a history, that has a long history in this world, and he interacts with this world in a very different way than, say, just you created your own weird elf orc hybrid and you're wandering around causing mayhem. And you feel like, and this is a character with a long history, with a long background. And when he's involved in these quests, you feel a responsibility to, and at the very least, I feel a responsibility to live up to this character. Like, I would actually go through my mind, it's like, oh, I'm thinking about doing this, but is this what Geralt would do?
Totally.
In this situation. And his relationships feel much more real with other characters, because you know he is somebody who has a long relationship with these characters. And you know the backstory, and the backstory feels real. Backstory feels real. Like his relationship with Ciri, which hasn't been explored in any of the games up to this point as much, but has been explored a lot in the novels. And when Ciri finally came back in this game, and in that moment when Geralt and Ciri finally met each other for the first time in a very long time, it really does feel powerful because of that. And of course, the music's awesome.
Yeah, Witcher 3 is definitely a generational game.
Yeah.
It's one of the best RPGs that I've... It might be the best RPG that I've ever played.
Yeah, no, I think it is.
Yeah, I totally agree with what you said, Bing, about the side quests feeling like complete... They feel like little short stories, and they feel like in a way that doesn't feel perfunctory or like a fetch quest. Like, it feels... Yeah. Like, even the farmer that you meet when you're, like, looking for this, soldier that, you know, defected from the army, like, he feels, like, real in his motivations, and he has a past and a history. Like, he feels like a real human being, and, like, that's pervasive throughout the game. It's just, like, an incredibly well-written game where, like, people in The Witcher 3, and I think what makes it feel like a real universe is that people are rarely bad or they're rarely good. They're mostly just weak. Like, people are weak in real ways that, like, make them feel like actual motivated human beings. Like, even the ones who do really despicable things, you know, are usually motivated by some twisted sense of duty or love. And, yeah, it's just, it's a really incredible game. And I love that you can, at least for me, like, the way that I played Geralt is I played him as a softie who, you know,
yeah,
rarely demanded money, was, you know, he let monsters off if they weren't causing too many problems. And I do, like, the idea of a monster exterminator is such an excellent premise for not just a game, but, like, a story in general, because it gives him an avenue into almost every social situation, because he is a necessary, he's a necessary professional in a world run by monsters, but he is also despised because yeah, he's an exterminator, and obviously, like, he's not entirely quote unquote natural in his physiology. But yeah, like, the story just, it's also like a huge story. Like, I was always, my mind was blown. It just kept going. It just wouldn't stop. By the time I got to Skellige, I was kind of burnt out. I was like, okay, I'm just going to mainline these stories so I can see the ending.
Yep.
But Yeah, it's also a series that has a really wry sense of humor about itself, which I really enjoy. Like it has a lot of fun playing with fairy tale tropes, and you're and like making like these sweet fairy tales that you're used to, and like reverting to like their horrible origins, almost. Yeah, it's just I should also say that the DLC are both also very good. Blood and Wine is maybe one of the best DLC like expansions that I've ever played.
Hilarious!
It's great. It's awesome.
Yeah, like ever made. Yeah.
And also Yennefer Forever. By Triss.
Yeah, I never liked Triss as a character.
I'm the odd man out here. I like Triss.
Wow.
No, I do like Triss too, but okay. I The Witcher 3 was the first I ever played of these games, and I just chose Triss because she was the first one. Like
I will say,
there.
I read the novels before I played the games. This is the one of rare occasions that I did actually do it in that order. So. Yennefer is much more of a developed character than the books.
The books are also very entertaining.
Yes.
As I said on the Witcher podcast that is never going to come out because this is on my old laptop, Yennefer is a woman, Triss is a girl, and girl needs a woman.
That's actually a fair statement. I purposely did not pick The Witcher as one of my few in the hopes and assumption that someone else would. Of the remaining choices, it is definitely it's the best game of the remaining choices that I had when narrowing down. It's the one I would rate the highest. I just wanted to be a little different and pick some that were more personal to me and my style of game. But yeah, the Witcher 3 is fantastic, and it has all the elements of the greatest of RPGs. And as you said, it's just so long, and it doesn't ever diminish. And as a fan of, 10 book long form fantasy series, this is,
Melisandre.
yeah. This is pretty damn good. This is what I look for and yearn for.
It's I think it also has some of the like one of the best character designs in the I can't remember what they're called, the three witches that are
Yeah,
those are just like every interaction with them, I was like, this is what I wish video games were weirder. A lot of the times, yeah. I feel like weird but good. Especially like the Bloody Baron portion of the game is
yeah, very Robert good. Baratheon. Yeah.
Absolutely. He's great. Yeah.
But like Robert Baratheon, a positive Robert Baratheon.
Right, yeah.
So Robert Baratheon trying to do good in a world.
Still kinda shitty.
Still kinda shitty, absolutely. But he's trying to get better. He's trying to get better.
Yeah, I love playing this game too. I think the main reason is what you said, Bing. The idea of Geralt having this history to him and the relationships of these characters having this feeling of being established, like, that's not something that happens in most games. Like, it's so hard to feel like there is that sense of history and that sense of a past and of this long, winding relationship that's gotten to this point. Like, that's special, and it's something that, like, I found so satisfying at the later stages of this game as you're playing out kind of the ending sequences. Like, it really felt like you were doing something with people that were important to you, which is hard to do. So it's a great game for so many reasons, and I'm glad it was on here. And I'm glad Skyrim wasn't. Anyway. Matt, what's your next pick?
Skyrim?
I guess the ones I'm going to talk about are Arkham City and Arkham Knight. In your original post, Zach, you said pick three, and then all of a sudden, at the very end, you're like, no, pick two.
Well, we're almost going for 2 hours, that's why.
Yeah, no, I understand your choice. So I just wanted to give a quick shout out to Dishonored 1 and 2. As it's my, as I said, I like stealth games, I like assassin games, and those two are my favorites of the bunch. They're definitely better than the Assassin's Creed games, and I even like them better than the Hitman games. And they're more immersive. It's just the focus on the story as well as kind of putting you, making it a first person game. It just makes the game feel more immersive as to how you're going through, and they're just, they're, you know, it's just a great assassin game with magical elements. And, they give you these, you know, they're almost, it's almost episodic where, you know, each level is kind of a separate, you know, hour long episode of you kind of exploring the level, and they're so big, and they give you, you know, so many different, options, which is, as to way to how to proceed, as well as giving you, a genocide or a pacifist, choice to make. And yeah, I just like the kind of, when it comes to assassin games, the best ones always give you the most options and choices of how to proceed and kind of create your own style. So yeah, so they were great. And then, so now I'll go to, the Batman games. So yeah, this is definitely a case where I just, you know, I like the later games in the series because they're more polished. Knight is actually the most recent one is actually my favorite, because of that aspect of it. And, you know, it's Batman, man. It's just a lot of fun. As much as Dunkey will hate it, you know, the games make you feel like you're playing Batman. And it's just such a fucking blast. And, you know, with the exception of the recent Spider-Man game, they're like the only like good superhero games out there. And so, yeah. And so it's, you know, it allows you to, fight with your own style. The Predator sections are obviously my favorites. And even though the beat 'em up brawls are ridiculous, they're fun using all the gadgets and stuff. It's a very long game. You get the full Rogues gallery, of characters. And, you know, I like superhero stories. So, they were a blast to play, and they're kind of the prime example of superhero games in this, past decade.
Yeah. I remember Arkham Asylum came out kind of like in the middle of the Nolan era Batman films. And I thought it was so cool that it kind of eschewed all that stuff and went back to kind of the traditional form of Batman that is in the comics and all that stuff. And traditional form of Joker and everything. And it was just like such a fun thing to experience at that time. Like Arkham Asylum in particular, like that map is so well put together. Like the actual like area of the asylum, like it's so fun to, again, like slowly piece together how this all fits and to find the secret places and to progress through and unlock new areas. And just to, again, like you say, play Batman, stealth around, take people down and feel like you have a presence over this place. That was so cool. And I think it is an important game too, right? Because it those games and that series of games really influenced so many games that came later and continue to, like Shadow of Mordor, the Lord of the Rings game. It's very much drawn from Batman, those games, and the Spider-Man game that came out this last year as well is also very clearly influenced by them. And I think it's such a cool like evolution of like brawler beat 'em up gameplay, and it continues to be iterated on and improved over time. And yeah, it was these games started all that, so they are hugely important for the decade.
I like that game a lot. One, because it's very doable. Like it's actually like Arkham Asylum specifically. It's very contained, and it feels. Like, it's not, like, it feels short, but in a way that's, like, I give it, like, a point to its credit, in that it's telling, like, a very tight and concise, like, exploratory story. And as someone who, like, really likes Batman, especially for the villains, I do like that it gives you this opportunity to just, like, go down the roster of, like, okay, check mark, like, who's left? Who have we not run into? Where's Penguin? Okay, I found his hat, I think. So now I can update my log and see what, like, artwork they have for him. Like, it was just, like, Arkham Asylum is just, like, an interesting, like, part of the Batman mythos and the idea of, like, being trapped there and being unable to escape and, like, exploring its origins and the history and how each villain has their own, like, setup in this, like, preposterous mental institution. Yeah, it was just fun in a way that I think is sometimes missing from a lot of, like, superhero video games, especially, or superhero anything, is, like, it's just, like, campy, like, almost, like, Burton-esque fun. Like, it really, like, it felt more like a Burton, like, adaptation of Batman than it did, like, anything that approached Nolan, like you said, Zach. Like, it felt more nostalgic for me for, like, the Batman that I remember from when I was young, like, the early 90s and mid-90s.
I mean, where you get more of the detective aspect, and you get some truly iconic performances from Hamill and Kevin Conroy, that really kind of, elevate the game, where it's, you know, it's a good mashup of stuff where the, you know, the story is more of just a convenient, you know, a convenient plot in order for you to, you know, run down the rogues gallery and fight each one. However, they, you know, get these great actors to come in and kind of inject something additional into the environment.
Is City the one that where it ends with Batman carrying Joker in his arms and he's super dead?
Yep. Yep.
That was a weird ending.
Right, yeah. You get Tally in there as well.
Yeah, that was definitely like when Mark Hamill was like, I'm done. I'm not doing it anymore.
Well, he shows up again in Arkham Knight as like a revenant, right? He's like haunting Batman.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Oh my god, I did play that game.
That game is all focused of, yeah, he's trying to kind of get rid of the haunting of Joker, and that's expounded on the fact that, you know, it's why they made Scarecrow the main villain, in order to inject that fear gas into him and to elevate that particular storyline.
Good series for sure. And a very influential one.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I will, I'm the last one, right? Yeah. I will talk about my last game. It's a weird one because I'm not going to talk about how great a story this game had. It's not a single player game like most of the stuff that we've talked about so far. However, the campaigns are really fun and you can get all of them for $40, I think. You can play the original, and the game is StarCraft II, the original campaign for free if you want, which I'd recommend on its own. So for me, this game came out in 2010. It came out at a time when I was really getting into RTS, particularly StarCraft I, that being real-time strategy, and just competitive multiplayer games in general. It was my second most anticipated game of all time, I'll say. I think it's fair to call it the last great RTS. That's one of the kind of storylines of this decade, is the slow death of RTS as a genre, as we always understood it. We still have some games coming out. Age of Empires 4 is coming out at some point. But it's just not really what it was. So that is definitely a thing that has changed over these 10 years. This is the only game of this decade that I have played consistently in every year of this decade. It's probably the most important game I've ever played in my life for a lot of different reasons. I think it taught me the value of competition and of practicing at something again and again to get good at something. It introduced me to a community that created some of the most important relationships in my life, and at the risk of getting too emotional and personal about it, it was always there for me, this game that didn't judge you when things in other parts of your life got difficult. And I know it will always be there for me until Blizzard decides to turn it off, hopefully because they are releasing StarCraft III, but there's not a lot of confidence in Blizzard at the moment. So I've been going to StarCraft tournaments throughout this whole decade, hanging out with my friends made online and also in person, and finding ways to connect with people purely through this shared interest in this game that has sustained for 10 years. I'm a big fan of sports in general, and in this decade, I've become a big fan of esports, largely thanks to StarCraft II. I know not everyone loves it, but I love seeing people compete at the highest level of and pushing games to their limit, and StarCraft II is one of the hardest games to do that in. So for all those reasons, this game is hugely important to me. It's in the essence of the game. It's an RTS game. You move units around, you fight, you do battle, but it's for me, it takes this new level of meaning because of the impact it's had on my life. And I think the most important thing for me with StarCraft is that it imparted to me some sort of, you know, philosophical life lessons that I still carry with me. Of course, the importance of community and shared interest, but the most key idea being the value of pushing yourself to be better every day. If you want a much better articulated version of these ideas, I'd recommend going to watch a YouTube video called The Day 9 Daily, Episode 100. I will link it in the show notes for this podcast. I promise it has value to anyone. Even if you don't even know what StarCraft is about, it's an important thing. So, yeah, this is a weird one for me. I do love this game, and I think, like I said, it's the most important game in my life, so I wanted to talk about it at least once, and it makes sense because it came out at the start of this decade, and it's been a game that's been important to me throughout this decade. But I moderate it through different reasons than I have with other games. It's not that it was like a super powerful single-player experience with a great story. It was just a phenomenally made game that meant a lot to me. So that's why I include that.
Oh, Zach.
Yeah. It's a big one.
Yeah, that's cool. I've never played it.
Yeah.
I've never played it, but I do like hearing people's stories about, like, series that have carried them through, like, sometimes decades of their life, you know?
Yeah, it's tough to see where this genre is now, see where, because I always loved RTS before this game. Like, I loved Age of Empires as a kid, and I loved a ton of games like that, so hopefully it has some kind of resurgence, but it seems like a thing of the past at this point. It's like a bygone era.
Yeah.
So, we'll see. But yeah.
I still remember good days of playing StarCraft 1.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Me building way too many carriers.
Well, and that's the strategy, right? They're so good.
Strategy, sure. You can put it that way. My only strategy in StarCraft 1 was building cannons in other people's bases and building carriers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll quickly tell my story of my first StarCraft game, which was StarCraft 1.
Yep.
So it was me and three other people who were just getting into the game for the first time, and we played against a friend of ours who had been playing it for the entire run. So at this point, StarCraft 1 had been out for like 8 years. So he was like, let's 1v4, let's see if you can beat me. This was my first game, so he was just like, try to build Zerglings, they're good. Just make Zerglings and send them at my base and kill the pylons. So that's what I did. I built Zerglings to the best of my ability. The three races in the game being Protoss, Terran, which is humans, and Zerg. Zerg are like bugs, and Protoss are like the super technologically advanced aliens. So I made Zerglings, I sent them at the base, and he just deflected it with ease and destroyed all four of us at once. And it was love at first sight from that moment, from getting decimated in that first game. So yeah, this is a big game for me. I don't have too much more to say about it, but yeah, it is a very important game for me. So I just wanted to talk about it for a little bit. Okay. So that will round out our, end of the decade thoughts on some of our favorite games. Does anyone want any other games they just want to quickly shout out as being really good that they haven't gotten to mention?
Skyrim.
Ah, yo. I'm just kidding. I'm fine with Skyrim.
I will, I have some brief honorable mentions. Bioshock Infinite, I think the racial politics of that game are, very suspect. However, as far as, like, I'm not overly concerned with, like, the mechanics or everything like, in a time travel story or a dimension hopping story, I don't really care about things lining up perfectly, but as far as there being, like, a really incredible final moment before the credits, like, that ending stuck with me for a very long time after I played the game. I will also say, if you want to, like, compare, like, graphical differences from the beginning of the decade to the end of the decade, it's very interesting to compare Red Dead Redemption 1 came out in 2010 with Red Dead Redemption 2, which came out last year. Dragon Age, man. Like, Dragon Age Inquisition came out in 2014, and DA2 came out in 2011. That is definitely a series that has gotten me through, like, the hardest parts of my life, and it's a series that, you know, it's like my forever series, you know, it's like the very dear to my heart. Pray to God that maybe, like, I don't know, like Winds of Winter or DA4, which will come out first. Who knows? I have more hope in DA4.
I have some faith in DA4. If anything, just to get BioWare back in some sort of, because I feel like Inquisition at least was a decent game.
Inquisition was good. Yeah. Trespasser made it even better.
So I feel like that's their last big hit of some sort of that, and I feel like they want to eventually make that go back to their roots. Who knows? Maybe.
Yes. I hope. Yeah. I was worried about the studio for a while, but it seems like they're in development right now. So, I'm trying not to, like, hinge my, like, mental well-being on, like, whether this game is going to come out. I went through, like, a period of suffering for that, and I'm like, I can't do it anymore. I can't do it.
I'll say quickly, my most, like I mentioned, StarCraft 2 is my second most anticipated game of all time. My most anticipated game of all time was Star Wars The Old Republic, which is another BioWare game, which did not end up being the thing I wanted.
Well, if anything, the Kotaku article is going to be great.
I can't wait, Jason Schreier, to tell us what happened.
Yeah, I think we did mention that, but there's, like, been more, like, BioWare think pieces than there have been BioWare games. And my last shout-out is for both Limbo and Inside, which are perfect indie games, in my opinion. They're both really relevant to my interest, which is just, like, dark, sort of, like, body horror stuff, which is, like, kind of, like, my niche. They're both perfect.
Anyone else got some stuff?
Oh, and also Amnesia the Dark Descent. Sorry. Okay, I'm done.
I'll shout out XCOM 2, of course.
Yeah.
Still playing it after all this time. Endlessly replayable. Especially with the expansion, War of the Chosen. Very fun. Although I will still say, I still think XCOM 1 with the Long War mod is still my favorite XCOM experience ever.
I can't do Long War.
It's so punishing.
That's
great about it. Anyways.
So, I mean, we've pretty much brought up all mine. Skyrim, Bioshock Infinite. I like Fallout 4 more than most do.
Yeah.
So it was fun. Yeah, kind of a common theme here where it used to be, you know, it was one thing where it used to be an annoying thing kind of having to do a single player game with a companion. But games like The Last of Us and Bioshock Infinite made that good. And, you know, and to a point where we now, you know, had God of War, which was also, you know, really good in that aspect. So shout out to that. And then, kind of the indie games I'm looking, you know, excited for their sequels are Hollow Knight and Darkest Dungeon. Definitely fun.
Can't wait for the sequels.
Yeah.
I'll also shout out Crusader Kings 2, I guess, for teaching us all about incest in the medieval era.
Best.
And of course, the Game of Thrones mod for Crusader Kings 2. Back when everybody still wants to play things associated with the Game of Thrones franchise. Anyways, go ahead.
That's a thing. Yeah, so I'd say, obviously, you mentioned Matt, Dark Souls. That whole series of games was massive for me in this decade. Dark Souls, Bloodborne, and Sekiro this year, all just incredible, and we've talked about those. My favorite game story ever is To the Moon, which is just another small indie that you could call a walking simulator. It's my favorite story in any game. We've talked about that a little bit as well. Well, shout out Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild, my favorite open world game I think I've ever played. We've talked about that back in the 2017 podcast, but it is just so good with exploration and just letting you enjoy that world. I'll say another indie, VA11 Hall A, which is a game about being a bartender in a cyberpunk world. It's also very simple gameplay, but I love the main character in it so much, so that's why it rates highly for me. But yeah, I think we've covered pretty much everything else I would mention. I'll also say Brothers: A Tale of Two Sons, a game that just probably, like, the game that I can most easily point to is doing that ludonarrative thing perfectly. Like, it just does it in the best possible way of seamlessly blending the gameplay and the narrative. That game was great as well. All right, so that'll wrap it up with our best games of the decade discussion. Before we wrap up the podcast, let's talk briefly about 2020. We've got some games that's kind of seeming like a big year.
Cyberpunk. Cyberpunk.
What if I forgot about Cyberpunk?
You're breathtaking.
Yes.
Yeah, those are two I'm focused on. We get them back to back in April and May, with Cyberpunk and then Last of Us 2. I can't fucking wait.
It's gonna be wild that time of year, for sure. Yeah.
Keanu Reeves simulator.
Yeah. Hopefully between then and now he doesn't say anything dumb on Twitter.
It seems like Keanu Reeves is an upstanding guy.
Yeah, he seems pretty cool.
Yeah, he seems like a good dude.
Yeah, looking at these Minecraft dungeons? What the hell is that? Anyways.
Like a Minecraft dungeon crawler like Diablo. Probably not our thing. Yeah, and the big thing next year, I think next year the PS5 or whatever it's called and the new Xbox come out. So that'll be...
Oh, really?
Sure.
That's next year?
I believe so.
PS5?
Well, I don't know why. What?
It's gonna happen. It has to happen.
Oh, God.
And a lot of these we've talked about so many times before because they just haven't come out yet. Final Fantasy VII Remake Part 1 coming out in February or March or whatever. I'm looking forward to it. But
I hope it's good.
It'll be interesting. Got some new Kingdom Hearts 3 DLC news that looks pretty good.
What the fuck?
Maybe makes the game better. We'll see.
Yeah, you'll note that Kingdom Hearts 3, one of the most anticipated games.
Absent.
Not here.
Nope.
Why?
Who knows? Maybe it never came out. Maybe they're still making it.
Looks like it.
Wait, what is this DLC, Zach? Like, what the
heck? I don't know, really. Like, it seems like it's like either like an alternate ending or like an additive to the ending of the game, or both. I'm not sure. I think they're trying to fix the game. We'll see.
If we had a most disappointing video games of the decade. It would definitely be on there.
That's fair to say. It's really all the big stuff. Is there anything else people want to mention?
Is Mountain Blade 2 actually going to come out next year?
Oh, yeah. Hopefully. That's been a thing for a long time.
I'll trust it when I see it.
There's a new Animal Crossing. I hope that's good. I love that game. What else?
Yeah, I haven't really looked at anything. I don't actually know really what else is coming out next year. I haven't done that much research.
It's very front-heavy so far. I assume, like, if the PlayStation and the Xbox come out at the end of the year, they're going to put some games with those, but
yeah,
we'll see.
I guess, yeah, the new Watch Dogs will be out next year. See how that goes.
Yeah, that Avengers game looks not good. We talked about that earlier.
Yeah, fuck that.
Neo 2 comes out.
Persona 5 Royal and Persona 5 Scramble. Phantom Strikers, the Persona 5 Musou game where you get to massacre shadows.
Perfect. Can't wait. The sequel for Ori and the Blind Forest comes out. Another really beautiful indie game. Love an indie platformer. Love it. Can't wait. Mm-hmm. I think that's it. Anything else?
Apparently Crusader Kings 3?
What? Also?
Apparently.
Really?
It's currently unscheduled, but it's up here.
That'll be interesting. Yeah. They can live up to everything that's been put into 2.
Yeah.
It's the tricky thing with their games, right, is they always start out kind of crappy. All right, we'll go ahead and call it there. Thank you all so much for joining me for this. Like I say every time, and like I think is obviously evident, love talking about video games so much. I like them a lot. And it was really cool to go through the entire decade, which had so many good games, and to hear everyone's picks and all the reasons why they would include them. So thanks, everyone, for that. And thanks, everyone, for listening to this episode of VOK. If you want to check out more of us, you can do so at VOKpodcast.com. You can check us out on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram. You can leave us a review on iTunes if you want to. That's always appreciated. And if you want to come chat with us, you can do so at the Podcast of Ice and Fire forums, which are very easy to find. Thank everyone so much again for coming on for this, and we'll see y'all again next time. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye. This was fun.
Always is. Appreciate it.
Back to replaying Sekiro.
I think I actually am going to go play Stardew Valley again with the new update.
Nice. The new update. I haven't played Stardew Valley since then. What did they change?
There's a new 14 heart romance event. Cool. After you're married, you get a new event with your romance.
important.
It is important. It's very important. Just a bunch of little things. I think they added you can harvest fish now, in your farm. There's a fishing building.
Nice.
There's an upgrade to the shed. Shed's bigger.
Sweet. Get to put more jam barrels and wine caskets.
Oh yeah, you gotta farm the wine.
This sounds a lot like The Sims, where it's just every upgrade is you get to buy new lamps. Look at these fucking lamps.
No. These things are actually important.
This is for money making.
Yeah.
It's an enterprise.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
I've definitely lost some friends for months at a time to Stardew Valley, so I understand that it has some narcotic appeal.
Oh, definitely. No. Yeah. You can make Krobus a roommate instead of a romance if you want to just make Krobus your roommate.
Okay, I'm playing Stardew again.
I forgot to mention. Yeah, I got Nier Automata here. I'm really excited to play that for the first time.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about it. I don't know. It's a lot. I can't talk about it without spoiling it. It's so much to.
Oh yeah, I mean, I'm I already know everything about it.
What is that game like? Is it a roleplay game? Is it an action game? What is?
It's like Bayonetta, kind of.
Oh, okay.
It's an action RPG.
It's more open world. It's not defined levels like that, but it's a platinum action-y, destroy stuff really fast game. But there's RPG elements, for sure.
Awesome. I've wanted to play it because everyone I've talked to really admires that game.
Mm-hmm.
It's a thing.
Yeah, no, it's definitely anime with like the crazy fighting. And as girlfriend reviews calls it, diarrhea Christmas lights.
What?
Yeah, it's like, yeah, it's their explanation for like basically like combat going on screen that you can't really tell what's happening just because everything is just like crazy and flashing and connecting and like hitting.
Sure.
And of course everyone's in scantily clad outfits.
Yeah, like girls with eye patches and blindfolds and like
right, yeah.
Frilly skirts. I'm like, yeah, this is anime. Let's put it under the microscope. It looks like anime.
So Matt, you're watching that new show. What else are you watching?
I mean, it's mainly just Watchmen and His Dark Materials right now.
What do you think about the second one of those?
Oh, I mostly like it. I don't know what's the best way to explain. The best episode was 4, where they introduced Lee Scoresby.
Yeah,
I like the change that's been done to his character. It was necessary because you can't beat Sam Elliott.
Right, you need to radically change the character to make it work.
Yeah, and it's like I was talking about this with other people, like. Probably the most egregious thing the movie did was wasting such good casting.
Right. Yeah.
And
it's,
so like,
it's also much better than I think the show is, right?
Well, no. I mean, yes and no. I mean, yeah. So for Lee, you have to go a different direction. I love Ruth Wilson. So she is perfectly great in this role. And McAvoy and Craig are the same person. So
no, they're not. McAvoy just doesn't have the gravitas to do this.
He's really miscast.
I don't think that at all.
I just don't think it works.
Yeah, I mean, it's only in one. I mean, it's only been in one episode so far. Unless he was, no, he wasn't. I haven't watched the back half of the 5th episode, but.
He feels both too scrawny and too young. And I don't, like, I think it's just because he's a super short dude and he has a very baby face.
Yeah, I guess the feeling too young, yeah, that does kind of make sense.
I don't know, like, he's supposed to be, like an intrepid Arctic explorer, and I just do not buy it. Like, James McAvoy is too pretty. He's too pretty to have been hanging out on top of the world for months at a time.
Yeah, I guess that's fair. Whatever. And yeah, and poor the actress from The Strain who has to try to follow Eva Green, who is the embodiment of a witch.
I still haven't watched the last episode.
Yeah, I haven't seen it.
So. I watched like half of it. There's a great scene between Serafina and Father Corm.
That's good.
Gior Mormont.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and I like them. Yeah, no, I like both him and
he's good.
San Salvador, like in there.
It's weird. Like, I've been thinking about this a lot. It's just like, it's such a hard series to adapt.
Yes.
Like, rereading it, like, it's so talky. Like, there is some action, but I feel like there's so many scenes of Lyra just having reams of context and backstory explained to her, which is all interesting when it's happening, but I think it's deathly hard to make that intriguing or stretch that out and like without deviating strongly from the narrative to like make that more cinematic.
Yeah, no, and I feel like most reviewers I've seen are kind of like they're somewhat unaccepting of like moving some of the story forward, and I much prefer that.
Yeah.
I just think they're not doing it the right way. Like, I conceptually am for it, but here's the problem with stuff like introducing or explaining that that Will's dad is Vladislav Grumman and all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like it that means nothing to the audience right now. Like, why do I care who Vladislav Grumman is or who Will Perry's dad is? I don't even know who he is at this point. I have no context for who that person is. So like they have this reveal at that moment, you're like, okay. Who cares? You know, so.
I mean, the introduction for that is for Will specifically.
Sure.
Right, he shows up in this episode, right?
He does.
It's just very hard to care about that subplot of the, I don't even know his name, Snake Dude going into the other dimension, because it feels, yeah. I don't know, I kind of agree with it. Like, I'm enjoying the show, but I do agree with Zach, where I feel like they needed to, like, change a lot more to, like, I don't know, to tell, like, a more emotional story, I guess? Like, it's kind of like when the little boy goes missing in the first episode, Billy Costa, and Lyra later, she's like, oh no, Billy Costa, and I'm like, wait, you guys knew each other?
yeah, you're right, that part specifically was off, like, not kind of showing.
Yeah, it's almost like...
intro between her and the Egyptians.
Yeah, they should have just, like, merged Roger and Billy Costa into one entity, like...
That's
a really good idea, yeah.
They can't because of how the upcoming episode ends.
Well, no, I mean, like, if you're saying that, like, they can't do that because they need, like, a kid to die to show how the incision works, it's like, you can just do that, be a random child, like, I think it would be...
Right, yeah, but it's more... But, I mean, this is a change the movie made, where it's more impactful to at least, like, know the kid that's dying rather than just being a random kid. Amory Duff more to do, like...
I don't know. I feel like that's a change that could have, like, it's more impactful for me, at least for Lyra, to be, if, like, Roger and Billy were the same person, I don't know, it just feels more, I don't have the right word, cohesive, I don't know, driven, motivated, less bifurcated in motivation.
Yeah, it almost feels like Billy is in a whole other story. Like, they don't feel connected to me.
But the demons look great.
They do look good. I do think this is, I think, my biggest problem with the show is, like, and I don't know how they do this exactly, but there's something that they're missing about what's important about the demons, about, like, the connection they have with people. Like, it's just not quite coming across.
It's so hard to convey it that,
yeah,
like, because so much of the description in the books is just, like, through feeling. Like, it's like, this is your soul walking around, this is the other half of your soul, and it's horrible when it's touched, and it's horrible when, you know, you're pulled apart, and it's like, in order to convey that, I think, I don't, like, the movie didn't do very good at that either. It's like, I don't even know how they would do it. It's like, they would need to do, like, more work about, like, I don't know, like, what the connection is, because it's like, it's not just, like, your little furry best friend. It's like, no, this is the most important thing in the world, and it's walking around outside of you, which means it's very vulnerable.
Yeah, I think they had gotten the dialogue right with the, like, exchanges between Lyra and Pantalaimon, and they did some of this that I thought was pretty good with Lee Scoresby, but just, like, the natural, like, back and forth of you and your demon, like, that the dialogue there is the key, I think, and I just don't think they've nailed that.
One thing I wish is that they had a scene where, like, because it's in the book where Lyra and Pan are kind of, they're testing the boundary of their tether, like, they're having an argument, so they start walking in different directions, and they hit the end of their length, and it's like, that scene does a lot to say, oh, you can't go far away, like, there's a limit to these things, and if that limit is stretched beyond its elasticity, like, you're probably both going to either be traumatized or die, and it's why that scene when she finds out that the monkey has been, you know, far away from Miss Coulter, like, just kind of fell flat for me, because it's like, I don't feel like we've done the work to establish that, like, there are limits to the range for how far you can go away from your demon.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'm enjoying the show as much as I'm like, it's more interesting to me to, like, study it as an adaptation, I think, than it is to, like, engage with it as a story at this point.
Yeah.
The Watchmen is super good.
Yeah, no, it's the best show of the year.
Totally.
I have, like, no personal context for Watchmen. I kind of know stuff about it, but I never read the comics or anything, so I don't know what my access point is into this. It sounds like it's just good on its own, though. So.
I mean, it's perfectly fine on its own.
Do you have any...
You'll just have to do more work, like, figuring out the backstory.
Only watch the Zack Snyder movie. Is it Zack Snyder?
Yeah.
I didn't hate the Zack Snyder movie.
That's probably his best movie.
Yeah. I mean, it's because he's basically translating it panel by panel, but...
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It wasn't terrible. Like, there's some stuff about it that I don't like, but... I don't know, I thought it was actually pretty good, as far as, like, a Zack Snyder movie can be good.
And I enjoyed the Zack Snyder movie more than most. But yeah, just go buy the book, Zach.
Yeah, the comic is it's good. It's good,
yeah,
man.
Like, nah, I should. Yeah.
It's like $20. Like, it'll take you a couple days to read. Like,
I should. I've been meaning to read more comics and graphic novels.
You know, that was definitely one of those. I mean, I read it, I don't know, 10 years ago or so. And yeah, it's like, it's one of those things that, you know, like, seems overhyped, and yet it's not.
I believe you. I'll check it out.
Something. Hang on. I feel like something just. Something big just came out that. Oh, Shinmue 3. That was it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Shinmue 3!
Sounds horrible.
Yeah, no.
Oh my god. Like, I'm never gonna play that game. I don't really understand the series very well, but like, the fact that that game exists and everything that I've seen of it is like, it's like someone took that out of a time capsule.
Yeah.
It looks like it came out of a time capsule.
Yeah. Such a weird thing.
Nostalgia.
Totally.
Yep. It's powerful.
I do think it's admirable that the guy that makes those games is like, yeah, this is like, part 3 of, like, 25. But keep dreaming.